Hey everyone, welcome to a special edition of the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. This week, I'm joined by my colleagues at Front Stretch, Mike Neff and Zach Tanzaretti. And guys, the theme of this podcast is the best of 2018. Now, we got a number of different categories that we're going to discuss. But first, make sure to subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on iTunes and give us that 5-star rating. And then Neff, you know, we're doing this Patreon thing. Tell them why they should help us on Patreon.
The more they help us on Patreon, the more we can do on Patreon. We're going to be doing a lot more with video and at shop and at track kind of stuff that we don't normally get to do with video. And the more that they can help us out there, the more opportunities we have to go to specific locations and do things and show them stuff that we don't normally get to do through the written word or through audio. And it's going to be a cool deal. Lining some stuff up already. I think next year is going to be a breakout year for our Patreon account. And the more they help us out, the more content and cool things we can bring to them.
And hey, guys, guess what? In that time, I subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast. So it's that easy. It doesn't take long at all. And a simple review or 5-star rating helps us out so much, more than you'd ever know. And like Neff said, you know, subscribe to the Patreon page and give us some money, and we'll give you definitely some more audio gold from our end. But guys, let's get started with this podcast, the best of. So we've got, I think, 8 or 9 different categories here. Zach, we're going to start off with the best paint scheme. So in your opinion, what was your best of paint scheme in 2018?
Yeah, for me, I really wanted to branch out from Darlington, because obviously you look at that race and everything, and of course those are going to be some of the best paint schemes going back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever time period they focused on. So I wanted to look at the Coke 600, and I picked Jimmy Johnson's scheme. Mm. He had that deep Lowe's blue car with the white hood, the white front quarter panels, and he had the white rims as well. To me, that was just a really colorful, just a beautiful scheme. And he actually ended up grabbing his last top 5 of the season all the way back in May.
Wow.
So nice. Apparently it was a quick car as well, but I loved how that car looked that day.
Cool. I'm going down with just Harvick in general, but he had multiple Busch Light schemes that I just really liked. They were a bit of a throwback to Cale Yarborough back in the day, but they kind of had their own look to them as well. But it just, the lines were crisp. It was really easy to read the graphics. A lot of the paint schemes these days get kind of muddled when cars are going by at speed. But when you saw Harvick's Busch Light scheme on track, it was really easy to pick up every time you saw it.
Yeah, that baby blue is definitely a nice scheme. But there's so many to pick from because, you know, besides Darlington, there's like 35 throwbacks. Each team now, each car driver has, I don't know, 3 or 4 at least primary schemes throughout the year. So I really like the Brad Keselowski throwback scheme. But going away from Darlington, I really like Ryan Blaney's rainbow PBG car. It was like a rainbowish car, and then the white wheel wells, and it just really stood out to me. However, he didn't do the best in it, and 8 times he ran it. Only had 3. He had 3 finishes of 30th or worse, a few top 10s. So maybe we'll see. I know in NBC's little vote, they had it made it to the finals against Chase Elliott. Of course, it's a popularity contest, and Chase Elliott's Mountain Dew car won.
Of course.
But I really like that car, and I hope to see it back next year. Now, guys, we'll move right along. Best quote. There's a lot of them. You know, when these drivers get out of their car right after a race, they're bound to say something interesting. So, Neff, I'll start with you this time. Your best quote.
Well, we all know the best quote of the year came right here on the Front Stretch Podcast when we were talking about it. And I don't remember what race it was.
Bristol.
But our boy Corey LaJoy, who never holds back, was making his predictions for the week and asked who was going to be in the number 22. And Dustin Albino, always on point, immediately said Austin Cindric. And LaJoy, without taking a breath, said, he ain't winning. it was priceless. And honestly, Cindric didn't have a bad run that day. But that was the Front Stretch quote of the year. Wow, we want to get into quote of the year in the series. It is almost impossible because there are so many of them, and I'm drawing a blank right now off the top of my head. Let me defer to Zach, and I'll think of one while Zach's coming up with his.
10-4.
Yeah, I had to do some research. I watched over a few Radioactives. I watched some Victory Lane interviews just to see if there's something I missed, And for sure, my favorite was from Kyle Busch at Chicagoland.
Same.
If you don't like that kind of racing, don't even watch.
Same.
And to me, that was great to hear a driver finally say that in front of the entire crowd, who was many of them were booing. And he's like, I don't know what you guys are whining about. That was an awesome race. And it was a terrific race. It was a great day for NASCAR. Great day for racing overall, and I just love the message that he sent when he said that quote.
Yeah, let me jump back to
Truex real quick.
Sure.
Because Truex at Martinsville was a great quote, even though he didn't back it up. Because he said, you know, again, he ain't winning was the quote. The quote has a theme here. But he said that about Logano when asked when he got out of the car about the championship, that he won in the battle, but he wasn't going to win the war. Parker Kligerman asked him what he meant by that, and he said he wasn't going to win a championship, and Truex said he was going to. And now, again, we know that in the heat of the moment, things get said and attitudes change after people sleep on it a little bit, but I was a little surprised that that Truex didn't rough Joey up a little bit more when it came down to brass tacks there at the end at Homestead.
Yeah, that hurt so much finishing second after saying that. But yeah, I'm with Zach. I also think Kyle Busch's quote is the best of the year because, I mean, let's flash back to that race at the end of June. It was NBC's first race, Dale Jr.'s first race in the booth. Fly job. Yeah, that was just a great race in general. And then Kyle Busch had probably a 10th place car, you know, and then Kyle Larson puts him in the wall in the final lap, blows a tire, spins him out. It was awesome. And yeah, that was one of the best finishes of the year. Which is a good transition because now we're going to do best finish of the year. So, Zach, I will start with you. What was your best finish of 2018?
Yeah, again, another tough category. I mean, for sure, I was looking at Chicagoland. I was looking at the Roval. I was looking at, you know, one of the Bristol races. But I have to go with Martinsville in the fall. To me, that was great because both cars eventually made it to the line. Truex was obviously kind of sideways, but he kind of kept it straight going. More on the line, they were both going for a shot in Homestead, and I thought the racing leading up to that final corner was tremendous. I mean, we had four or five cars under the blanket just going back and forth. So I would have to go with Martinsville in the fall. That was certainly one of the more memorable ones I've ever seen.
Mine's Chicagoland. I mean, it was a mile and a half track, and they're racing like they're in Martinsville. I mean, that was the most insane thing about that. These dudes are adoring each other and bouncing off the wall and freaking slide jobbing, and then the bump and run to finish the thing. And yes, he spun him out, but he did make it back to the line, so it wasn't like he totally wrecked him. But it just, to me, that like Kyle said, if you don't like that, I don't know what you want. Because I thought that race, the finish, had everything that you want out of the finish of a race, aside from somebody upside down and on fire.
True, yeah, and there were a lot of good finishes this year, which is a good thing for NASCAR and for fans and for us to cover it. But I got to go with the Roval because there was so much uncertainty going into that race, and it lived up to all of its expectations. From practice on Friday and Saturday to qualifying, Denny Hamlin wrecking twice going to a backup car. But then we got down to the final lap, the final little two corners, and you had Jimmy Johnson going for his first win of the year, sent it into the chicane on the front stretch and spun out himself and Martin Truex Jr., allowing Blaney to get by. Meanwhile, like 20 seconds later, Daniel Hemric comes in, spins out Jeffrey Earnhardt on the same chicane. Kyle Larson's 45 seconds back or so. Earnhardt can't get the car started, and he passes Earnhardt to make the playoffs to the round of 12. That was just, I don't know, just it was a good first. It was a debut race for the Roval, and it lived up to all of its expectations for sure. Zach, I know you were there, and that was some of the most insane things I've ever seen.
It was crazy. I don't know. You didn't keep up with it.
All right, now we'll move along to the best race of the year. I know we're moving this aero package next year. I'm not the biggest fan of it, and I know we've only seen it once, but we truly had some good racing this year, guys.
Yeah, we did, and I'm kind of with you on the aero package idea. I know that the drivers weren't big fans of it, and it's going to be a little different than what we saw at the All-Star Race, but it's kind of hard to argue with the All-Star Race up until the very finish, when Harvick at the end kind of stretched his legs and ran away from everybody. But the majority of that race, you saw group racing that was kind of pack racing but wasn't total pack racing. And I feel like It'll be interesting to see what this does next year. But for me, I think I'm going to vote that that was the best overall race of the year.
Zach?
For me, yeah. Obviously, another tough category. But for me, I had to go with the fall race at Bristol, I would say. There was quite a few yellows, some long green flag runs, fun stories to watch, some tempers. Nobody really dominated. I think it was Chase Elliott, Blaney, Logano, and Bowyer who pretty much diced the race up evenly with around 100 or so laps led. Big wreck early gave us a comeback story to watch with Kyle Busch. I mean, just a terrific drive that he put on right up until the end. But amazing race. I mean, Bristol's absolute blast to watch, and it was really cool to see Kurt Busch even drive to his last win with Stewart House Racing. So there was a lot I took from that race, but I overall thoroughly enjoyed that one.
Zach, you and I are agreeing a lot. It's kind of scary because I might be a little biased because that was my first time attending Bristol in person. But that race also lived up to its expectations. So much badass racing. Like you said, Kyle Busch spin on lap two, triggering a 12 or so car pileup. Went to almost three laps down in stage one. He was about two car lengths from getting lapped by Blaney for a third time. Came all the way back to a shot at the win late in the race before blowing a tire. Yeah. And then he got into Truex. Truex kicked his car. I mean, it was just great racing. Cars running the bottom, the old Bristol, the top, the new Bristol. It was just a badass race. And yeah, I agree. I think that was the best race of the year. And I know in Jeff Gluck's weekly, was it a good race poll? Bristol got, I think, 94%, which is the highest it's been in 3 years, the highest race he's ever recorded. So that was indeed a great race, in my opinion. Now, guys, there's also a lot of good celebrations in Victory Lane this year. So I guess, Neff, I'll start with you. What was your favorite?
For me, you get down to the end of the year. I mean, there's something about crowning a champion and just that moment where they know that they're the ones that did it. And seeing Joey put his kid in the trophy was just, to me, that was my favorite moment of the year because there have been so many expectations on Joey Logano, and fair or unfair, the shot he was given at Joe Gibbs was not what he deserved. And the fact that he came all the way back from that and is now at the top of the sport. And in all honesty, I like the way he did it. You had some people get their panties in a wad about Martinsville and moving Truex, but he's always raced that way. And back to the, you know, who wears the driver's suit in the family comment at Pocono. He is not afraid to move somebody. He's not afraid to rough somebody up if it means he's going to win a race. And I don't know that he gets lumped into that category as much as Harvick and Busch do. But if you look at his history, that's kind of how he races. And to have it all culminate and finally live up to the sliced bread moniker, I thought that was the coolest celebration of the year for me.
Zach?
Yeah, for me, I'm going way early in the season, all the way back to Atlanta. This is Kevin Harvick. When he won that race, he held three fingers out on the fun stretch. Obviously, he was paying tribute to his 2001 race that he won during, obviously, a very, very important time in the sport, paying tribute to Dale Earnhardt, who he replaced, switching to the 29. He waited 17 years to do exactly that again, and I was there, I was covering that race, and it was just a really special press conference even afterwards, him talking about it. It seemed like a career stamp. I mean, he came back to where his winning started in the Cup Series, and he finally got to do it again, this time with his son in Victory Lane as well. So that was a really cool tribute that he played. It was something I kind of didn't expect, but obviously it was something that he was waiting to do for a really long time.
Yeah, that was a nice win. It's crazy that he probably should have won five cup races at Atlanta since his last win in 2001. Yeah. He's been so dominant at that track. I'm also going to go with Harvick, but it's not Atlanta. I was thinking about doing Michigan because we all know he dominated that race, then put Keelan in the car, had Keelan get the checkered flag. That was just a good family moment. But guys, I really think the Texas race, although the Texas race in the fall was very boring, because Harvick dominated the race, it was the selfie heard around the world. He took a fan out of the crowd and put him on the track, a selfie right in front of the car. So, you know, the slogan is people say that kids drive NASCAR. Well, that's an easy way of selling the sport when you take a fan out of the crowd, especially being a little kid. I mean, he's probably the man at school on Monday. So, yeah, so that was just a cool moment, a feel-good moment. But moving along, guys. Biggest surprise of the year, Zach?
Biggest surprise of the year, I mean, yeah, it's tough to really point it out. I mean, I know for a few of mine, I tried picking out some breakout drivers and stuff like that, but I know for my breakout guy who was pretty big of a surprise, I would say, was Chase Elliott. I mean, I think he did way more with Chevy than anyone else did. Yeah. I mean, Larson never won. He finished nearly a full race behind Elliott in points. But even that aside, if you zoom in further on what Hendrick was able to do and how they performed, I mean, it was terrific what Elliott ran in comparison to Bowman or Johnson and Byron. I mean, he wasn't near the top of what Harvick or Kyle was doing, but I think if you put him in a Toyota or a Ford, I mean, I don't know how much better of a year he would have done, probably a lot better, but he still won his first race. He got three wins out there, and I mean, he didn't make it as far as he could have, but I think with what he did and what he had, I mean, that was a surprise. And I think going into 2019, we can see even a better year for him. I think 2018 really kind of laid the foundation down for an even better year next year.
Now, Neff, I don't know your answer, but I feel like we may agree because we were kind of riding his bandwagon all year.
Actually, I was going to go down another path in a surprise of a disappointing fashion.
Okay.
And we can go ahead and put the warning label at the front of the podcast now. Jimmy Johnson ran like a bag of ass this year. And I understand people have off seasons, and we saw it with Earnhardt in 88. After he dominated in 87, they couldn't find a rear end with two hands in 88. But he still won a race, and he still had moments. And Jimmy Johnson's moments were a top five. You know, it wasn't – there were the outside of the Roval, there wasn't really much of a shot of him winning a race. And to see somebody that's 2 years removed from winning their seventh title to tie the King in Dale, I really was stunned that they fell off that badly. And – you know, it may just be a thing. I know in talking with some crew chiefs, they've pointed out that the ride height rule has kind of really hurt Jimmy and Chad, that their expertise was getting the car platform down on the track and keeping it there with the ride height rule. And now that that's gone and everybody's down on the track all the time, they don't have that differentiating factor. But with that kind of talent behind the wheel, it is stunning to me that they didn't have the occasional flash of brilliance. And I'll defer to you, Dustin, for yours, because I know where you're going.
Yeah, I'm going. I mean, you got a lot of good points about Jimmy Johnson. But trying to make this podcast positive, so I'll go Eric Almirola. Neff, you rode him all year long, even back to Daytona the night before when he did a podcast saying you thought he was going to win the 500. He came out two turns short and then got dumped by Austin Dillon. But it's funny because we knew he'd be a lot better than when he was at Richard Petty Motorsports with the equipment that he has at Stuart Haas Racing. But he had four top fives in 36 races. Obviously, the 10 car never had a top five in 191 races prior at Stuart Haas. He had 17 top tens, which is more than his previous 3 years combined. One Talladega in a dramatic fashion with Kurt Busch running out of fuel in turn four. And it was just a consistent threat for the win, especially in the second half of the year. I'd really say Chicago on when he won stage one and maybe... No, he didn't win stage two because Harvick and Busch had that cool ending. But he ended the year fifth in points, leading 180 laps, which is more than his first 244 races combined in the series. And, man, if he finishes fifth in points in his first year, obviously now they're in year two coming up, being Almirola and Klausmeier, so... Guys, I don't know. I feel like Almirola is going to continue on the upward trajectory going forward. And, I mean, hell, maybe he was one of your guys' biggest breakout stars of the year, Zach.
Definitely was for me. I know I put my expectations up there in February or so, and I didn't really expect much from him in that 10 team. I thought they just had a lot to learn. I never knew where to put my expectation for Eric personally as a driver. I just... hadn't seen enough potential with the 43, but there's only so much you can do with the 43. And he proved he was a piece of gold in that car the whole time. And all he had to do was kind of align his experiences, align with the good crew chief, good engineers, and an epic race team. And he was able to do some great stuff. So I think year two, man, I don't know what we're going to see, but it's probably going to have more than one win for sure, I would expect.
Neff, your biggest breakout driver?
I think we got to, at least for my money, it was Chase Elliott. I mean, again, kind of like Logano, the expectations have been there. Knocked on the door 8 times before finally breaking through, as we all heard about. But the fact that he won 3 races, it's one thing to win that one race, and I know we argued about it when it happened, that I thought it was uneventful and uninspiring, and y'all thought it was amazing. But the fact that he then went back and did it 2 more times, I thought, to me, that solidified him continuing as a potential star in the sport. It's a long way to go. Obviously, he's got to win a championship or two before you really look at him as a superstar. But I think he's at the point right now with the Camaro kind of going into its second year, and Hendrick probably making some strides towards being faster next year. And he was the shining star for Hendrick this year. I think you're going to see Chase Elliott has kind of made that first, I don't want to call it a big leap, but it was definitely a bound in the direction towards being a superstar in the sport.
Yeah, so for this one, I'm going to go on a bit of a limb. I'm going to open it up, not just to the Cup Series, but the Xfinity Series. And I'm a little biased because he was on our podcast 3 times, but I got to go Ross Chastain. No, you know, he made the playoffs with JD Motorsports, and then that, you know, performing higher than his expectations in that car, what his equipment would, you know, give him. He got 3 rides, 3 race deal with Chip Ganassi Racing, which led to a full-time deal next year, hopefully still, depending on what happens with DC Solar. I would just say that through the first maybe 2/3 of the year leading up to the playoffs, the Cup playoffs, it was one of the best feel-good stories of the year with him, you know, paying his dues in the Xfinity Series and Truck Series for 5 or 6 years with Brad Keselowski Racing, got fired from Ricky Benton Racing, I think, in 2014, but then found Johnny Davis. And to bring them to the playoffs in that number 4 car, which is severely underfunded. I mean, he outran guys like, now, like Michael Knapp, but, I mean, he's in the biggest team in the Xfinity Series. So, for a small team, a little David beat a Goliath, I mean, that's pretty impressive. And I don't know. And then you look at what he did in the Cup Series, too, in the 15 car. Just a lot of amazement coming from Ross this year. I'd always finish, he'd bring the 15 from with a 3 in front of it to a 2 in front of it in the finishing order, which that's a big deal running that far back. But, guys, moving forward, best team, Zach.
Best team. I mean, I definitely wanted to go towards Elliott, but if I were to go out a little bit, I'll probably go towards, and it's really hard. I mean, the whole year we've kind of been going back and forth between Kyle Busch and Harvick. But I always look at Kyle Busch a little bit. I know Harvick's numbers were just a tad further up in most of the categories. But they both won 8 races. And I think Kyle, just as a driver, I think he was just an epic guy this year. He was able to win in incredibly dominating fashion, like the Coke 600 leading all but 25 laps or so. But he also won races that perhaps he should not have. And he did it in kind of both ends of the style. He made it homestead again. But I think you know, the entire team always is able to put together good cars, and Kyle was able to drive them. Another guy I wanted to give a shout out to was the 2 team and Paul Wolf, kind of in that same area of winning races they weren't supposed to, having a good car but not dominating. He was able to get that number 2 into position with either good strategy or good pit stops, good restarts, and Paul Wolf and Marcus Lowry, on 3 straight races heading into the playoffs, and they kind of fell off a bit after that with some bad luck. They weren't able to rekindle that same success, but I still wanted to give them a shout out, because anytime you win and you're not specifically the best car, I think that shows a lot from the crew members and the crew chief as well.
I got a couple different ones that I'm gonna enter in this category. First up, Kevin Harvick and his team brought the best card to the track, probably 32 out of 36 races, points races this year. I mean, they dominated in fast cars at the track, but they only won, what, 8 races?
Yep.
So it's kind of hard to flag them as the best team when they failed 60% of the time. So it's, I mean, I got to give my hat to them because it's been a long time since we've seen that kind of dominance out of a team unloading every week. I mean, it goes back to the Jeff Gordon years of 97-ish where they were just every week they showed up. Everybody else was kind of racing for second. But they shot themselves in the foot so many times. And it was generally mistakes by the team, whether it was the driver or the crew chief or the pit crew, somebody was making mistakes. And needless to say, that's all of the team. So I kind of have a hard time voting them as the best team when they had that many mistakes. So the one I'm going to pick, and it's one that I picked to fail for much of the year once it was announced, but I'm going to go with the 78. Those guys had so much adversity, and I preached all year that they were going to collapse under it, and they never did. And they went all the way one spot short of going back-to-back for the title. And it's a credit to Cole Pearn and his leadership. It's a credit to Martin Truex for staying level-headed and on point. It's a credit to Barney for giving them everything that they needed and helping them realize that he was going to take care of them. It was a team effort in the worst of times to turn around and almost win a championship. So my vote's going to be the 78.
Crazy that one of our best teams could not return next year. That's just insane, in my opinion. But I'm with Zach again on this one. I also think it's the 18 of Joe Gibbs Racing. I mean, when you think of a team, right, pit crew, crew chief, crew guys, back of the shop, whoever, it just seemed like whenever this team was up against the wall, Adam Stevens and the pit crew stepped up and delivered. And I'm going to take Homestead, for instance. Bush had the worst of the championship four cars late in the going, and Stevens made this bold call late in the race, which, you know, had the caution not come out for Daniel Suarez, ironically Bush's teammate when Brad Keselowski got into him, he would have been a lap down and no shot at the championship. But the caution did come out, and, I mean, it gave him a shot at the championship because he won the race off pit road. Now, albeit he finished fourth, over the final 15 laps, only behind Logano, Truex, and Harvick. But he had a fighter's chance, whereas before he didn't, had that call not been made. So, I don't know, I just think Adam Stevens, he's one of the best crew chiefs, obviously, in the garage. And since he and Bush have paired up, I mean, it's been unstoppable. So, I would expect another big year for them next year, and who knows, probably the best team again. So, guys, last category of the best of 2018. Neff, I'll start with you, and we'll go best driver of the year.
I would vote Kyle Busch. I mean, if it's just pure driver talent and ability. Again, I just talked about it with Harvick. Harvick had the car to win 32 races this year, and he won 8.
Could you imagine?
Kyle had the car to win 5 or 6 races this year, and he won 8. So I at this point, and it's one of those deals where when Tony Stewart was racing, I would take Tony Stewart over anybody because he could win at anything with an engine. And I feel the same way about Kyle Busch. If you put him in anything with an engine and give him just an hour to get used to it, he's a threat to win.
Zach?
Yep, I agree. Yeah, I gotta stay with the 18 car. I mean, if you look at either Chicagoland or the Richmond races, Bristol, I mean, he was able to show that he can do anything in any type of car. I mean, I'd love to put him into probably like a mid-pack car, like a Roush car, and even like a Chevy, you know, with Hendrick, and see what he can do. I'm sure he can do great things, but that was a really good stat. My Neff, for sure, when you look at how many races the four car dominated and what their losing percentage was, I think the 18 wasn't the dominating car nearly as much, yet he won the same amount of races. So I think stats like that and then just watching him drive that car, he's a show to watch, but you can't lie when you look at stuff like that.
So I guess it depends on how we say, like, how we view best driver. Like, best pure talent on the field, I would say Kyle Busch, too. And I rode his bandwagon all year before the year started when Zach and I did a podcast. I said Kyle Busch can win the championship. I said it right before the playoffs, he's going to win the championship. And I said it in Homestead, he's going to win the championship. Now, with all that said, I think Kyle is the best driver in the sport. But, I don't know, in my opinion, it's just, it's hard to go against Harvick, even with all those mishaps, most of which were his pit crews. Now, we're doing just the best driver. Like I said, best team, I think, is the 18 team. But if you look at Harvick, you're right. He probably should have won. I mean, 32 is a little unrealistic number. But he did have a car that could have won probably 30 races or so. But I would say he probably should have won 12 or 13, especially after he won three of the first four. And then the All-Star race, and then won two more at Dover and Kansas. And over the final 24 races, only won three times. But he was always consistent. He had that speed, like you guys said. Ended the year third in points, but a career-high 8 wins, 23 top 5s, and 29 top 10s. So, yes, consistent, though snake-bitten, whether it was penalties or the pit crew. But regardless, Harvick was my driver of the year. But you could be torn on either one. I would go, if you asked me tomorrow, I'd probably say Busch. So, and the next day, Harvick. So, it depends on how you view driver of the year. But, guys, that's all the categories. Any final thoughts? Because this is the final podcast of 2018.
Yeah, I got one more category. I got one more because Neff brought this up before when we were talking about categories. I wanted to see what he had because I looked up some best trophies. And, yeah, Neff, I wanted to see what your best trophy was. What was yours?
You still got to go with the clock. I mean, there's clock, just... Yeah. I love the big cup that they used to give you at Bristol. I always thought that was just a really, like, a prominent trophy that kind of lived up to the hype of Bristol. But there's just nothing cooler than the clock. And, I mean, that's... Yeah. And it almost makes me sad that they give it to the trucks now, because it used to be they only gave the clock for winners on Sunday at Martinsville. And so for years, the truck winner did not get a clock. And the winner of the cup race and the winner of the late model race got a clock. And that was always a cool thing that the late model guys got lumped in with that clock. But now they give them for the trucks as well. But it is just so unique. And the fact that it's built right down the road. And the thing that I didn't realize until probably 2 years ago is that they give you that clock, that not the one that they have on stage, but one that's boxed up that night. You win the race, and they literally give you that clock, and you have to put this big crate on your hauler to take home. And that was why when Boyer joked about they were strapping it to the hood of the SUV, he may have, because they literally give you this big crate that's got this $35,000 grandfather clock in it that you take home. And same thing with the late model race. Those guys, a lot of those guys don't have really massive haulers, and they got to figure out a way to fit that somewhere in their stuff to take it home the night they win it. And I just, that to me is still the coolest trophy in the sport.
Zach, I'm guessing you had a favorite trophy?
I did. Of course, you can't beat the Martinsville clock, but I did some research, and I remember being at Talladega this year, and they showed us what they called the Vulcan Trophy. That's at Talladega. It's 3 feet tall. It's made of hot poured iron, and it weighs over 100 pounds.
Jeez.
That thing was pretty epic to look at, just a monumental piece of iron. They call it ironware instead of hardware, and it definitely fit in with Talladega. And to me, that was a really cool trophy. I think they debuted it last year, but they brought it back on for 2018. And yeah, that was just a badass looking trophy. But yeah, you can't beat the Martinsville clock and how they hand that out, because that's got some tradition in there as well. So I definitely appreciate that side of the sport too.
Yeah, that Talladega one will be interesting if it's kind of a tradition now. It seems like it is. If you said it was debuted in 2017. That's a big ass trophy, 100 pounds. But I agree. Yeah. I agree. That clock is
really big.
I agree. That clock is very, prestigious. Obviously it's got a lot of history behind it. And I agree that maybe they shouldn't give them out to the truck drivers, maybe give them a watch or something. I don't know if Martinsville decides to go in that direction, yeah, just give credit to me. But seriously, like, I don't know. I think it does. Neff, do you know when they started doing that? Started giving to the trucks?
Gosh, I want to say it was about 2010, 9 or 10, something like that, was when they started doing it. Yeah. I don't really know why they did. They just, one year, decided they were going to start giving them to everybody.
I don't know. I just, it kind of, this is going to sound bad, but I don't mean it that way. It just kind of cheapens the clock on Sunday, in my opinion, by just giving them out left and right.
It's still pretty hard to win one.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Oh, I know. No, for sure, but... Yeah. I mean, you could say, oh, Kyle Busch, go run the truck race. Go win a clock. And then he wins a clock. It kind of cheapens it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, any final thoughts besides?
It'd be like they gave a Harley J. Earl to the Xfinity winner.
Right. Yeah, that'd be crazy. Yeah, yeah. All right, guys. Any more final thoughts before we sign off?
My final thought for 2019 is that I can't wait to see what Steve Phillips brings to us for 2020. I feel like there's big changes coming to the sport. There's some changes about how stuff occurs, but I'm hoping there's going to be some changes to the schedules. And we've heard a lot about Nashville, and it seems like there's momentum headed down the tracks on that one, and that would be an amazing thing. But I just hope that, kind of like the Eldora experiment, I hope that we run this up the flagpole with some short tracks for Xfinity and for trucks in 2020 and get back to the roots and get back to these smaller tracks. And when we do, fans better get their asses out there and support it.
Right.
Yes.
But once they do, then we will hopefully get, I mean, even if it's midweek or short track races or whatever, we need to get back to the short tracks because where we've thrown about everything we can at these mile and a half tracks, and the excitement just isn't there 90% of the time. And if you want to really get buzz going, you need road courses and you need short tracks. And there's so many short tracks that have a history with NASCAR already that we could get back to. And I mean, it doesn't have to happen every year. Go to Hickory 1 year, go to South Pole Boston the next year, go to Langley the next year, you know, go to Evergreen Speedway, go wherever you go, you know, mix it up. But we need to get back to these little venues. And I know everybody's like, well, they don't have the infrastructure, they don't have this and all that. It doesn't have to be a big cup race. It's 10,000 people. Sure, it's $250 for a ticket. because they got to make their money and they don't have that many seats. But it makes it special, and it makes it something. The Masters is the Masters, but part of the mystique of the Masters is it's so hard to get a ticket. Not everybody can walk up and buy a ticket to the Masters. If you run at Hickory on a Wednesday night in July and they have seating for 9,000 people, that's who gets in. If you're 9,001, sorry, you can go over there and sit on the side of the cemetery and watch with binoculars.
Yeah,
because it doesn't have to be available to everybody. You can watch it on TV, but it will get us back to our roots.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And you think about like the big races, obviously Daytona has 101,000 seats or whatever, but you're right, when it comes down to old school short track racing, 10,000-15,000 seats. But look at Darlington. I'm not sure what their seat total is, but it's probably, I don't know, 40 or 50 or whatever, 1,000. And it's sold out every year now that they've gone back to throwback weekend. And this would be a true throwback going back to all these short tracks. So I would say that, look at Eldora. Sure, they have, 10,000 seats as well, but people pack the campgrounds in the hill with the chairs or lawn chairs. I was talking to someone that went a couple years ago just the other day, and he said it was one of the coolest things he's ever done in racing. So, I don't know. I think 2020 is definitely going to be an interesting year, and we'll know in about 6 months or so when the schedules come out what 2020 looks like. So, all right, guys, any final things?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you guys. Those midweek races, that option has me excited. The Nashville thing, the Nashville Fairgrounds, seems to have more traction to it. Me and Neff will talk about that a little bit, but that, among with all the driver changes and all this stuff, the new aero kits for the mile and a half tracks and all that, I mean, a lot to look at. Anytime an off season comes to an end, I am just completely thrilled. And knowing that, you know, Christmas is done, now we're going into the to New Year's finally, and I'm definitely completely pumped for the new year and all the opportunities that are going to come. So, yeah, this was a great year of podcasting. I think this was, our second year, Dustin, of doing it, like the of us doing it together. Yeah, I think we started in 2017 and having Neff on board every week. It's been a hell of a blast. We've had a lot of, we brought drivers on this year, which is just awesome. I thought we'd never be able to do that consistently. And I feel like I've learned a lot more about the sport because of the drivers who have come on, and we've had awesome discussions. So I just want to thank Funchtach and everyone for the year and all this cool stuff that we got to do, because this was a blast.
Yeah, I echo those words. I also never thought we'd have been able to get drivers on, and I've also learned a ton about the sport with having Neff on, who's been around the sport before we were even born. and also having these drivers on who've been around the sport pretty much their whole life too. And it just brings some cool insight that we didn't have last year, or, you know, you, not even at, like when you interview them in person, you might not get that. It's just, I don't know. It's kind of a different aspect of the sport, and it's really cool. So, with all that, guys, thanks everyone for tuning in, throughout the year in 2018, and we'll be back in January sometime for another podcast. But until then, happy holidays, and we out.
Peace out.
Bye.